listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We are truly blessed this morning because we have legendary documentary maker, author, but most importantly, investigator, and someone that's prepared to stand up for the truth. It's Keith Hunter. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Rodney.
It's a long time since I've seen you.
Yes, it is quite a while, but you're out of town for some reason.
Yes. Yeah. But you awoken me or took away from me my naivety.
Well, there's a naivety particularly in the Watson case, naivety doesn't work. You need to be.
Does it work?
No.
So how was it that the police, the media, and our courts came to convict an innocent man, Scott Watson, for a double murder?
For a whole heap of reasons, but one of the most driving was the performance of the Crown prosecutor, who, to my mind, put a false case to the jury nonstop. If there was a single reason, I would put it on Mr. Davison.
Paul Davidson, was it?
Yeah.
But where I lost it in reading your great book, Trial by Trickery,
yeah,
a fabulous book, mainly a disturbing book.
Okay.
But in the documentary, what was it called? Was it the same name?
No, it was called Trial by Trickery, Murder on the Blade, question mark.
That's right, Murder on the Blade. What disturbed me most greatly back then when I read your book was I expected fearless journalists to be probing, the checks through the police force and Crown Law to be questioning and checking, and our court system to always err on the side of caution. None of that happened.
I have no answer for that. You have to make up your own answer, Rodney. I don't know. I agree with you. Those things should have happened because some of the things I said were pretty serious. But no one did a thing.
Tell me how the Crown convicted him falsely.
Through the office of Mr. Davison. But he told the jury some things that I thought were absurd. One of the things he kept saying was, there were two issues, basic issues. One was the existence or non-existence of a ketch, a two-masted yacht, which the two were said to have, by people at the time, that the two got onto. And the other one, that's the main one at the moment. There's another one, but I keep losing things, Roddy. Ketch is the first one. And Davison kept telling the jury that the ketch didn't exist, or it didn't exist unless it was in the place that Guy Wallace, the water taxi driver, put it. Now, Wallace was constantly unaware, not put fully aware of where he had let the three missing people off, the two missing people off. And he kept telling the jury that if the ketch that was seen by many, many, many people, it was identical to the description by Guy Wallace and others, it was seen by many, but as far as Mr. Davison was concerned, it didn't matter if the ketch wasn't in the place where Wallace let them off. So if it was an irrelevant ketch, unless it was in the right place. But Wallace didn't know where he let it off. He tried this and he tried that and he tried everything. He didn't know.
You can understand, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he also, when it came to the identification issues, he was heavied by one of the policemen. He kept a policeman he spoke to, who auditioned him, kept blaming him or putting him on the ketch itself as part of a murder team. So he was scared to death, I think, throughout that.
I didn't realise that.
Yes. He was told consistently in an interview to which I have an account or a transcript, he was told that he was part of the guilty party.
Oh my goodness.
He responded to that, I think, frequently. Now, he saw me some years after that and told me that he had told the jury, the court, that the catch was in the wrong place. So when Davison was saying all the time, if the catch has to be here where Wallace put it, then it's not the right catch. And in fact, Wallace put it after the hearing, several hundred yards away from it. So the whole thing was a nonsense. In fact, the whole trial's a nonsense.
We had the hairs found after.
That was the other thing. That's the other issue. Now, how did those hairs? They weren't there in January, but they were there in March. And suddenly, in March, it's found, when they're found, there's a little snip in the bag of hairs that they came out of. The little half-inch slit in the bag of hairs. How did they get there? No one knows. But to my mind, there's only two ways, only one way the slit could get there. Somebody put it there. And there's only two reasons for it. One is to put something into it, and one is to put something out of it. It's one of those two things. That's what that slit said. The slit that the bag of hairs had the slit in it. And so no one knew how it got there or why it was there, and they didn't know about it until the defense counsel pointed it out in the court. So
that alone is damning.
Absolutely.
That alone, the fact that they've produced two hairs of the deceased or the missing in a plastic bag as evidence that they hadn't seen, the police didn't discover in January, was it?
That's
right. But discovered in March. Simultaneously, there's a slit in the bag that was sealed. That alone would say over. Because someone has tampered with the evidence and it's been in police custody this entire time.
That's great. And it wasn't seen until then. Yeah. The other issue is that the woman scientist who had examined the bag told the court that she probably didn't see the hairs, the blonde hairs in it originally, because she didn't put a lot of time into it, she told them. basically, that's what she said. And then
you say, okay, let's accept your testimony, so you're incompetent.
Indeed. Indeed, but the other thing about it was that she didn't see them in the bag because all of the hairs were in there. She didn't point out that 99% of the hairs in the bag were short brown hairs. The two that she found later were long blonde hairs. Now, how could she not see two long blonde hairs in a bag full of short brown ones? Because she didn't see them in January, but she did find them in March. Now, if there's corrupt or improper evidence there, it's extraordinary. And yet he got convicted on that basis.
We had the famous scratch marks.
Yeah, the scratch marks, and they went beyond the hitch cover goes down on the boat, and the scratch marks went out to the edge of the hatch, so you couldn't scratch on it when it was closed. Now, we're supposed to have a closed person inside. She didn't push at the hatch. There's no lock on the hatch. You just pushed it to get out. But if you're going to scratch on it, why scratch on the outside where you can't reach it because it's on the boat? Do you understand me?
Yeah, of course. You don't scratch. So scratching at a hatch is pointless.
Yes.
But you can't scratch past where the hatch is closed.
Correct. But it was scratched. The scratches went right to the edge, yeah.
And this became damning.
Yep.
We also had the ever-changing story of Scott Watson's movements and the speed at which his boat could sail around the Marlborough Sounds, which you showed in the documentary by sailing a boat to be impossible.
Yes, yeah. All of these, look, just everything in the prosecution case, to my mind, is impossible. Every element in it is useless as in a murder trial. It should have been tossed. It should never have been brought.
And Scott Watson is still in jail.
He's been there for 26 years. He's lost his entire youth. Gone. Yep. And they're still wondering about what to do. And here, we've just had this Court of Appeal hearing, which does bother me because it's not looking at half the important things. It doesn't look at the whole case. It only looks at what the defence has brought to it, but the defence hasn't brought the whole case to it at all. Heaps and heaps and heaps of stuff that should be put before this tribunal. There's not going to be heard, none of it. I find this whole process. That's the other thing, Rodney, that bothers me about this case. It seems to me to to make a mockery of our trial system. It doesn't seem to me, in this particularly in this case, to be about getting the truth. It's about winning a game.
Yes.
And if you look at what the two sides do, particularly the prosecution, because I think it had a horrendous task in trying to make it work, but they worked. But you look at it, they don't treat it like looking for truth or justice. They're just trying to win an argument.
You can see if you have a civil case and you and I are in court arguing and we get our lawyers to put our best case and win, and your lawyer puts his best case and tries and win, the judge has got to sift through it.
That's fair.
But when it's a criminal case, the Crown has an obligation, actually, to be fair and reasonable because it's a citizen.
Absolutely.
But they took this like, we're going to convict this guy. That's our job.
That's what they did. Well, I think we're going to win our argument is what it's all about. It's about winning in court and not losing. It's not about finding truth or anything to do with justice, not in this case. And I think it happens infrequently, in these criminal cases in court. It's about winning a case, winning an argument, not about truth or justice.
Okay. I mean, to me, Blind Freddy could literally see the nonsense of this case.
Yep.
Right? But we know how persuasive lawyers can be.
Yeah.
How a jury can believe the police.
Yep.
Come hell or high water. How they can be outraged by the death of two young, beautiful children. And how they can't believe that the police would be bringing a case if they weren't certain. Indeed. And away it goes.
Indeed. But the number of things that were ignored at the trial are extraordinary. Like, for instance, there were two or three people who saw the young couple 2 days after they supposedly went missing being pushed into a public hotel in Blenheim. There was no emphasis put to that at all.
If I recall correctly, Keith, that observation was by a school friend, or someone who knew.
Absolutely, yep.
It wasn't like a stranger thinking, oh, I'd seen the picture and it looks like her. No, they knew her.
She saw,
and they called her name and she turned around.
And she said, I think she said, can you help me?
Yes.
She said that a couple of times to people who saw it, can you help me? They went nowhere, yeah.
And we know, it's so upsetting.
Mm.
It's almost, and I'll come to this, but it's so upsetting, it's so monstrous that you can't sort of hold it in your head.
True.
But we know that there were repeated and multiple sightings of the so-called mystery catch all over New Zealand by boaties who knew their boats.
Right. But Davison took care of that by saying, it doesn't matter about the catch. If the catch wasn't in the place that Guy Wallace put it, then it's irrelevant.
Yes.
He said that over and over again. And
he's a sophisticated, intelligent man, and the jury said, oh, wow, if Mr. Right. Davison says that. But
get to get the name right, Ron. It's Davison.
Davison.
The defense attorney was Davidson.
Oh, how strange.
Yes. And the prosecutor was Davidson.
Ah, and thank you for that. When people would ring in saying they'd seen the catch, police weren't interested and didn't take the note.
I suspect she got the police would have got calls from dozens and dozens of people who saw the catch, and they were told we're not interested. Some were told we've got our man.
And in the police records, which you've been through assiduously, those reports aren't there.
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, there are some. There are some, but not a lot, yes. There are some. Not nearly as many as the people that came out afterwards and spoke to me and other journalists. Who said they'd seen the catch. But as I say,
I had a, I'd say, friend, an acquaintance who I knew well, And he saw the kitsch.
Right.
And he told the police, not interested.
Yeah. Well, that
and he, every time I'd meet him, he was so angry over it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I say, that happened to dozens. It's been reported many times since by many people. And the police just said, no, they either said we're not interested or we say we've already got our man. We just go away. We don't want to know. And so, see, this is the thing that gets me, that Inspector Pope and the police team arrived on the job on the 6th of January. And on the 8th of January, they were searching Blade, Watson's boat, and with the written down expectation that they would find evidence of murder. And they put that in a document on the 8th of January. They'd only, the investigation had been going for 2 days, and they'd already made up their mind. Looking for, from that time on, they didn't look at a single other accused person. That tells me that they found out from somebody who put Watson in hock on it. Somebody told the police that Watson did that, and he did that before the 6th of January. There's no other way they could have come up with that unless they were just looking for anything. Just the nearest the nearest person. I think they were told by somebody that Watson was the killer, and that's the person that the police should be looking for, the person who told them about Watson.
Yes.
That's who they should be looking for.
And, of course, there's a well-known thing in life that you can don't like to be wrong, and it's very easy to have a false theory and then to be picking around in the weeds, convincing yourself that you're right. And it's a very hard thing to do, to say, well, hang on, let's think about what would make us wrong. And the police around the world and through history are well known for deciding on the criminal and then gathering the evidence to fit, rather than going in there open-minded and saying, let's gather up the evidence and see what happened here. And you can see through your book, through your documentary, that the police, as you say, made their mind up right at the start and then put a case together to convince a jury that he was the man.
That's exactly what happened. Yep.
Because the strange thing that happened was, if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, that on a retrial, they gave up on the original description of how the murder was done and the travel movements of Scott Watson. Have I got that correct?
I'm not sure. Is this 20 years ago, Roddy?
Yeah.
Some of the details I've lost. But
didn't they do a thing where, because you'd shown, was it the two-trip theory or something like that?
That's one of the most disgusting things of all. It really is. You remember the theory?
Tell us the two-trip theory.
Well, the trial went on for 6 or 8 or 2 or 3 months, and it went on, and no one knew about this two-trip event, but Watson had said, and it was recognised that he had gone back to his boat. Now, and the person who took him back to the boat had been verified. So Watson said, I went back to my boat, and I went back with this person, and this person said, yes, I took Watson back to my boat. And that was the argument throughout the entire investigation. And then at the very, very end, on the second day of the
trial, right,
the very end of the trial, on the second day, Davison suddenly came up with, yes, he went back to his boat, but then he went ashore again. That's the first time this was ever said in the court, to the courtroom. It's the first that Watson knew he was supposed to have made two trips back to shore and back in on the second last day of the trial. Now, there's justice in that somewhere. I can't find it, really.
Well, the whole point of a criminal prosecution is that the prosecution discloses their case to you.
Indeed.
They disclose their case to you before you go to court.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the best chance of rebuttal. Why? Because we'd rather, as the saying goes, 10 guilty men go free rather than one innocent man languish in jail or worse.
Yeah.
This theory of what happened. 3 months in court happened, what, last 2 days?
On the second last day of the trial, the defence discovered that their man was supposed to have gone to his boat and then went back ashore again. And when asked about, when put to Davison, he said, "We don't know how he got there, how he went back, because no one said they'd taken him back. He had no means to get back to shore. Someone would have had to come forward and say, I took him back from his boat to shore and then brought him back again." So neither run of the two trip, the second trip, was known to anybody. No one said we did. No one was asked. Davison just said, it doesn't matter. We know he was back there. It doesn't matter how he got back to shore. Well, I think it does matter.
It's...
And to do that on the second last day is not part of the hearing, not part of the case, not part of any argument at all until the second last day of a 3 months trial. Wow. That's our justice system for you.
There you go, listeners. We're listening to Keith Hunter, author, documentary maker, investigator, written one, actually, two of the great New Zealand books.
Oh, thank you.
Trial by Trickery, and we won't get into this today, but The Missing Bloodstain, which is a riveting account of the crew murders, which is a whole other story. But strangely to me, it's a Scott Watson one that is so obvious that they've got someone who... Not only, oftentimes you find it, oh, well, there is they haven't proved the case, therefore he can't be convicted. In this case, the evidence is that he's clearly innocent. The evidence clears him of the murders. Yep. That's the crazy thing. It's not like, oh, well, we haven't proved he did it. No, you proved that he didn't.
I think that's what the case did. Yes, it proved it did. But when you've got a Crown prosecutor of the reputation of Mr. Davison, it's a lot to get against. And when he withholds his case until the second last day of the trial, so you cannot answer it. This is after all the evidence has been given. It's his last spoken argument to the court was that Watson went back ashore. But how did he do it? No. How did he get back to his boat? No. Doesn't matter. We know he did both. That's what Davison told the court, and that's what the court bought. It's astonishing.
There's a whole lot of funny things too, because as I recall from your book, I don't recall it from the trial, but I recall it from your book, that, have I said it's a wonderful book?
Yes, you may have.
Bears repeating though, doesn't it?
Indeed.
They didn't charge him for a long time, and that allowed the police and the media to blacken him.
They did it for 6 months. At the beginning, the policeman Pope complained about the activity of the press, and then giving stuff away on Watson, and then they didn't tell the press for 6 months that he was an official suspect, so the press could do what they liked, and they did. They condemned Watson from day one to day 60, nonstop.
He was convicted by the media, being fed by the police.
Yes,
for the people of New Zealand, for 6 months before it went to trial.
That's correct.
And they painted him.
Before he was arrested,
yes, of course. Oh, my goodness, yes.
That's right.
Before he was charged.
Yes. And throughout that 6 months, the police were telling the press off the record that Watson was the killer. And so all the Sands murders material that went out in the press was anti-Watson.
And yet we know that the police had made their mind up on January the 8th.
Yep. They didn't look to any other suspect at any time.
Or any other theory of how the murders were done.
No. Not that I'm aware of, anyway.
Well, you've been through everything that's there, Keith. The media blackened him for being a little shady, right?
Indeed, yeah. Yeah. He wasn't your perfect 18-year-old, but all of that stuff basically goes back to when he's a child, an 18-year-old. This is 8 years later.
Yes.
He's been accused of murder.
But that's an amazing process, isn't it? He wasn't Jesus. He wasn't perfect.
Indeed.
Therefore, we'll bring up these other things.
But,
and then they had pictures of him, like mugshots.
Yes, the blink photo. It's people identified Watson, the principal eyewitness people, identified Watson on the basis of his eyes. They remembered that the guy, the real person, had hooded eyes or kind of squinty eyes. And the police happened to have one of the photos they'd taken had caught Watson halfway through a blink. And this was used by the police and the prosecutors to point out that this correlated with the descriptions of the guilty man. He had slitty eyes. Well, Watson's eyes were slitty because he was caught halfway through a blink. And that's the photograph they handed out to all the witnesses to this person. So they also saw Watson in a blink photo, not a real one. And so they responded to that. And the police actually took the original picture they had of Watson out of their bunch of pictures that they put to people, and they put this one in instead. And from there on, everybody identified Watson because of his eyes.
You can't get
much in this case that's not of that character.
No, no. And that's why it's easy, literally, in an elevator, that famous elevator conversation that you have with someone, to destroy the case. It's that simple.
Yep.
Not complicated.
No.
See,
I don't know why all this happened. There's something at the beginning of it that I can't work out. I've even thought the possibility that someone in the police force, maybe Pope himself, was involved with these people. Because there's no question in my mind, to me, that Ketch did arrive here. It came from overseas. It had something to do here, and I suspect it was on a drug mission. In fact, I've in the last week discovered that there was a police team chasing drugs in Blenheim at the time. That's only just come to me in the last week.
Isn't that amazing? Still material coming forward.
Yes, yes.
But that's the way you feel, because it wasn't about the feeling that you get looking at it, because it was so over the top, get Watson, that it was shielding someone or some group.
I've had that suspicion for a long, long time.
Yes. That's how I read it too. Because with the, say, the Crewe murders or the Bain murders, whatever the truth of those, for now we'll put that to one side. But there was a connection, you know. That you could say, well, he could have done it. With this one, this is just literally an innocent man sort of going there in the pub, and then next minute he's arrested.
Yep.
Because there's not one shred of evidence, not one shred of evidence that would suggest he murdered them. And there's exculpable, I can't say the word, that every bit of evidence proves he didn't.
Correct. Yep.
Now tell me, Keith, your whole career has been, I'm not going to say journalism because it's bigger than that, but you've worked TV, writing, investigation, all the big documentaries, Keith Hunter. Why are the journalists so useless? I mean, we know they're useless now because it's a lack of money, but we're talking back 26 years. Why were they so useful? Wouldn't this make a journalist's career or a TV news product make them this. Well, you know, like we had with Pat Booth, you know, where you had this journalist who exposed the truth. Why wasn't there a young Pat Booth, other than Keith Hunter, in a newsroom saying, I've sat through that court, this is rubbish?
Well, I had more knowledge, I guess, than the people. I don't blame the press in quite the way that you do. All of their information through that 6 months came from the police. They had no reason not to believe it. So when they got to the arrest of Rod Watson, they knew why he'd been arrested, because he was a bad guy, because of all these things he had done, all the stories that they got from the police. And that's all they knew. They didn't know there was anything else. So, I mean, Pope and the police team did an extraordinarily good job in bluffing the press. I don't blame them at all. I'm a bit disappointed. Interesting. I'm a bit disappointed that my book didn't have more effect, but there were quite a few books on the case have come out at the time. But all they knew about the case came from the police. They didn't have any other knowledge at all. So you can't really blame them that period.
Gosh, you're a lovely man. I won't name this journalist because he's a friend and he sort of told me this in confidence. But a journalist became friendly with me because he wanted stories when I was in Parliament, and he'd covered the court case. And I said, what do you make of it? Oh, he said to me, this is a smart guy. Watson did it, but they never proved it in court.
That's what you get from people. That's what happens.
Isn't that, and that's what you're saying, is the impact of that 6 months.
That's right. They destroyed his character. Absolutely. Now, he wasn't a nice guy at the time, right? He was an 18-year-old. He'd been in a lot of trouble here and there. None of it very serious trouble, but minor issues. So, and the police had all sorts of things on him. And so that's all they got. That's the only knowledge they had. There was no one out there saying the police that Watson's a good guy. Well, he wasn't a good guy. He had been a naughty kid 10 years ago. But after the 10 years, not at all. There was one event, I think, at about this time, where we had gone down to his boat and he found that somebody was stealing his dinghy. So he got really angry about that and he pulled out some sort of sharp thing and pointed at them and said, let my dinghy go. And he got done for that, for some sort of assault.
Well, I'd do that.
Yes, I know. Who wouldn't? But he got convicted of some sort of assault issue there. So that's the only thing in the last 8 years of his life before he got arrested. So in that he was clean, apart from this event. That's all.
Well, I've remembered that conversation all this time, and I thought, wow, here's a smart guy who doesn't understand justice and what the court process is about, and how you don't just convict someone in your mind. It's actually got to be in an open process in court. And if you can't do it in an open process in court, he's innocent. So this guy, and that's the funny thing, right? If he'd been on the jury, he would have convicted Scott Watson, but not on what he heard in court. Because that's what he did as a journalist covering it. He convicted him for outside material that was never tested.
Well, the police succeeded. That's what they wanted, and that's what they got. Yeah, well, Detective Inspector Pope, I don't fully know his role in this. He was the man that ran the investigation. He was the one that made all the decisions. He was the one that dealt with the police. And I discovered just last week, he had this directive to his team that they are not to speak to the press at all. There was a woman, particularly, especially appointed from the police force to deal with the press, but she wasn't allowed to talk to the press. She could only put out material that Pope had given her. So everything that went out to the press, to the people through the press, was actually written or directed by Pope, not by the woman who was supposed to write the press material. So
26 years on, people are still coming to you as a clearinghouse with information about what went on in this case.
Yes.
That's extraordinary in of itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
There are a lot of troubled souls out there.
Hmm.
And you'd like to think that it'll be someone out there who wants to cleanse themselves or get it off their chest before they die?
I couldn't say that. That's a nice thought, but I'm not at all sure that it's so. I mean, I'm still of the view that that Ketch was an overseas boat that came here on business, and the only business I can think of was drugs. And as I say, I quite recently discovered, in fact, there was a police team in Blenheim at the time, run by Pope, that was looking for there on drugs issues at the time.
And it's not fanciful to think that there are boats coming into New Zealand with drugs. That happens regularly. It's not fanciful to think that a guy that's shipping drugs into New Zealand could abduct two young people and murder them.
Sure.
None of that is fanciful. I mean, that's a more likely scenario just off the top of your head.
Indeed. But I still don't understand why the police picked on Watson so quickly, within 2 days of arriving there. How could they possibly have made up their mind so that they didn't look at anyone else ever?
Just particularly Watson. When they never had the bodies.
Quite, yes. So in my view, somebody told them that Watson is involved with this, somebody who knew what had happened, who was involved in the happening, and knew that we'd go to the police sooner or later and put up a suspect immediately. And the police bought it and didn't look anywhere else ever. So whatever information was given to the police, it came in such a way that it fooled them completely.
Well, it could have been the police themselves.
Who knows?
Tell me, Keith, how did you get into this case to begin with?
I don't know.
Seriously?
Oh, I'm serious. Yeah, I mean, there has to have been something that I just followed in the press, or had a worry about it and started to ask questions.
What were you doing at the time?
Ooh. Well, I was making documentaries at the time. I also directed drama at the time. I could have been doing something as a drama director. I don't know. Look, Rodney, I've asked myself how to get involved. I don't know how I got involved. Something, there must have been something I saw in the press that I thought was worrying, and I started to ask questions.
The first person I met on this case was Mike Gallagher.
Right.
Did I pronounce his name right?
Gallagher. The K.
Okay. Yeah. He wrote a book called, is it called The Mystery Ketch? No.
Yes, it's something like that. It's over there. It's on my desk somewhere. Yeah.
He made an appointment to see me in my MP's office.
Oh.
And he came to see me and he gave me a copy of his book. And I, like you, I don't follow cases particularly closely in the media because I think, oh, well, you hear one side, hear the other side, I'll just wait. But something about this case troubled me, but I hadn't studied it. And then he gave me his book, and I found that shocking. And, of course, this was early days. And then your book, and then meeting you, and then watching your documentary. And I'm fully aware that there is what I call the documentary effect, that when you're reading a book or watching a documentary, you're only getting one side. You know, you're getting the defense or the prosecution in reverse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I read them critically. And you can't argue with a slit a plastic bag and 2 years being found that were blocked amongst a bunch of people. Well, that is inarguable. That either is true or not. And then once it's true, the case is gone. You can't argue with them presenting a two-trip theory and no one taking him ashore, not knowing. You can't argue with this crazed idea that it doesn't matter. If the catch is not exactly where the witness says it was, then it doesn't exist. I mean, that's absurd in logic and in evidence. And you can't argue with we decided that this guy, 2 days into it, and never charged him for 6 months so we could deal to him through the media. And all the jury, of course, were tainted by 6 months of media.
Yep.
As were the journalists.
It may be that I got the idea from Kernighan's book, because I met him very early in the piece. Ah. I may have.
Well, what a champion he is.
Yes, indeed. Yes, he's still there, I think. Yes. Yes.
And so for listeners, Mike Gallagher was a very experienced boatie, and his interest was piqued because, as he explains it, you can't mistake, I can't remember the boat terms, but you can't...
Now it's gone from my mind.
A schooner?
One's a slip and the other's
a sloop and a catch.
That's right. Catch.
And he says, no.
One mast. Yeah.
No one who knows the first thing about a boat could make that mistake. And then the other thing was, I recall, it's all coming back to me, was the idea of them climbing up on the boat rather than down onto the boat off the water taxi.
That's
you
right.
Don't mistake that.
That you cannot mistake that evidence. The people who did who were there said they reached up to the boat to grab hold of it. But if it was Watson's boat, you had to reach down. I mean,
I remembered another bit. Now it's all coming back to me. It's great talking, Keith. Watson, excuse me, I just have to have a quick cough. Watson was tied to another, was it two boats?
No, not that I recall, no.
When he parked up?
Oh, he was in a group of three. Yes, that's right, he was, yes.
Yeah, and he got these two people on the boat.
Yep.
Murdered them,
and no one noticed.
Raped and murdered them, supposedly, and no one noticed.
Yeah.
They slept through it, like literally side by side in little wee boats.
Yep, and when you get into one of those boats of the three, that rocks the other ones. So,
yes.
So, and no one.
They wake you up. When you get on the boat, you wake up.
Yep.
He woke up the neighboring boats when he got on his boat.
And the boat he was tied up to had 11 people on it, and not one of those people heard a thing or felt a thing, not one of them. And yet Watson was supposed to have gone to his boat twice. The second time he came back with the missing couple, they climbed onto his boat, and it's just a little boat. I mean, when they get onto the little sloop like that, it rocks the sloop, and they rock the next ones next door, and no one woke up because of it. No one heard a voice. They didn't speak to each other. They said everything was in silence. When Watson arrived there with the missing pair, they didn't talk to each other at all because no one heard them, and they would have. It's pretty sick stuff, really. And what's worse is this current hearing. I don't know that they've actually got the material, because they stuck with what was given to them by the defense at the beginning. I don't think the defense has put everything to them. They should have my book. They should have my
absolutely
book. They have all the material, but they haven't, and they won't know about it.
There's one thing about you getting into this. There's one thing about looking into it a bit deeper, but it's a whole huge amount of work to write a book on.
There's two. Yep.
That's a huge amount of work, and a huge amount of work because there are two lives lost. There's an innocent man in jail, and you're taking on all the powerful institutions in New Zealand and questioning them. So when you're writing such a book, it's not like everyone's going to read it and say, oh, yeah, yeah. They're going to be looking for any little mistake they can. So when you're writing such a book, you have to be so careful.
You've only got to get it right, Rodney. It's not hard getting it right. Just make sure you got the facts and you don't print any non-facts, unless you call them some sort of non-fact, I don't know. But it's not that hard, really. I mean, it took a long time to research the book, a long, long time, because I got everything I could get in terms of evidence and responded to it. But and you don't get scared of it, printing the stuff if you know you've got it right. If no one's ever said I've got anything wrong in the book.
No one.
No, no one. So that's happening.
The book came first and then the documentary?
Other way around.
Documentary and then the book.
First, yes.
The documentary aired on TVNZ?
Yes.
Wouldn't you think? You would be expecting him to be free in a month.
Could have, yes.
You'd be expecting that, though, wouldn't you?
Well, I thought it would have a positive effect, but it had no effect at all. Except what it seems to me, in fact, I've pulled away from the case in the past 10 or so years simply because while I think that I've helped Watson in terms of his public image and what the people think of his guilt or innocence, I don't think I've done any good with the justice system. I think you put a critique out, and that is clearly a very negative critique of the case and in some cases of the people. You put that out, and I've got a feeling your name's tagged unpleasantly. So I actually pulled away from Watson simply because I thought I was now doing him harm in terms of the justice system. Good for the people.
You're such a good man. You're such a lovely man.
That's very kind of you.
No, it is. Because I can see how you'd think that in hindsight. Because at the time, you think you're exposing the truth. But if you've got a justice system and a police system that just doubles down, then they can't now admit they're wrong because you had that evidence all those years ago.
I have to say that if anybody on the Court of Appeal panel happens to listen to your radio station and gets this piece, I'd really like them to suggest to them that they read my book and get a copy of the documentary, because I think they have material there that no one else has dealt with. And I think they should know about it and they should get that material.
When I met you the last time, probably
a while ago,
15 years ago, 12 years ago, when I was in Wellington, I was no longer an MP, so I can date it a bit. You'd never met Scott Watson.
I still haven't.
Isn't that amazing? Because you just dealt with the evidence.
Yeah. I've met his father, who's a most remarkable man. His extraordinary knowledge and a calm interior and exterior. He's a great guy. But no, I've never met Scott. I've met his sister. I met his mother when she was alive. She died about 10 years ago. But I've not met Scott.
I met the dad. I met the sister. And I was sat in court for one of his court appearances.
Oh, God.
And saw him. And I've been to a couple of protests with his dad in Christchurch, with his dad. And I never forget sitting with his dad in that courtroom in Christchurch, because he knew me, because, you know, I'd been a public figure. And I went and sat beside him and spoke to him afterwards. And I couldn't stop crying. I literally couldn't stop crying. And even to remember it, to be a father and to sit in that court and watch your country rob your son, and to know that these people know what they have done and won't speak the truth for your son, for justice, for all of us, for each of us. I often close my eyes at night and I think of him in prison, and wake up in the morning and think of him in prison. Imagine what it is for the dad, for the sister, for the mum when she was alive. That's heinous in itself.
Dreadful.
I think I would rather be the one in prison, if you know what I mean. I think it's like when you have a loved one, you'd rather take the beating than actually have to witness them have the beating, because you know you can endure it. But to see a loved one hurt is unbearable. And we are an extraordinarily passive people in the faith of authority. We should read your book. We should watch your documentary. I tried to interest, when I was still in Parliament, MPs in it. Didn't care. And they'd sort of wave you off. And I realized this better in hindsight. Because they'd wave you off and say, oh, you know, there's always someone complaining about a conviction, you know. And you say, well, that's true. You don't think I'm stupid, do you? No. Well, you can't read this book. And I said, it won't leave you with questions. It will leave you with the truth that he is innocent. Oh, well, we don't have the system. The system. What? The system? There's a man in jail. Couldn't get through, Keith.
No.
I tried, you and I, the reason you came to Wellington and we meet up was because we met with Andrew Little. Oh, you may have forgotten that.
That's right, I had forgotten. Yes, in part, yes, I do recall that.
And I got Andrew Little, who was in opposition, to come to my house in Wellington and for you to meet with him. And we sat on our little veranda and you walked him through it. He had read the book. He 100% agreed with you that there was a question to be asked.
Oh, I'm not sure I knew that.
Yes. He gave an undertaking, not that he would free Scott Watson, right? He was more cautious that he would get looked into. He became the Minister of Justice.
Yes.
Did nothing. And you and I approached him subsequent when he was Minister of Justice, never heard. And that's when you realize that sometimes your faith in other human beings can be misplaced.
If I wasn't talking to an ex-politician, I would agree with you.
No, it's inexplicable to me. And much of my time in politics was inexplicable because it selects for a certain type of person who goes along with the group, right? Because if you're a renegade, you're not going to get in. That's why I much preferred, it's a funny story, right? When a funny idea, but first past the post allowed renegades. Because a renegade could be popular in the party at his local level, or she. The party hierarchy could hate them, but not do anything about them being selected. They get selected to Parliament, and the more they're a renegade, the more popular they are at home.
Right.
And so you'd have your Trevor DeCleans and your Mike Minogues and, people that didn't toe the party line. And they would speak their mind. And they were so much fun on TV, right, because always causing trouble and speaking outrageously.
I was trying to remember, a couple of days ago, I saw the name Mike Minogue in the paper, and I thought, Who on earth was Mike? And I couldn't think, but you're right. I recall him now, Mike Minogue. Yes.
He was a National MP that, along with Marilyn Waring, sort of stood up to the then Prime Minister.
That's right.
They were... Oh, there's a guy in Invercargill whose name I forget who had a limp. They were great guys because they sort of, if you went to them, they'd speak up.
Yes.
But now an MP owes their entire allegiance to the party hierarchy because that's how they get on the list. Trevor DeClean was never going to make it to cabinet. Like, he just knew it because he was outspoken.
Was he not in cabinet?
No, he was an undersecretary.
Oh.
And he never made it cabinet. And it suited him because basically...
It freed him from saying what he wanted.
Clearly. Yeah, but basically he knew he couldn't sit there and be the one that didn't agree and then have to march out and pretend he did. I mean, that's horrific when you're in cabinet. Cabinet decides against you and you can't say, I didn't agree with this.
I didn't mean to get into politics here, but what do you think about the present cabinet?
I think it's dire. I think we've got – I thought the last government was horrific, but at least I had hope of something better. This present government, I actually truly give a 0 out of 10.
Yeah, I'd give a minus a 10 out of 10.
I really think they're terrible. Yeah. I think Chris Luxon's terrible.
I agree.
They have no vision. They can't explain why they're doing things. They do these little things. It makes them look petty and small-minded.
I think he is petty and small-minded. I think that's revealing the man.
I think so.
Mm.
I tell you another thing that troubles me about him. I've become a Christian, Keith, just by the by. But before I became a Christian, I became a Christian last year. But before I became a Christian, I looked at Chris Luxon and I thought, I don't have confidence in this guy. Because if you're a Christian, you've actually got to live by it. And so you've got to say, look, I'm a Christian. I've got views. They are my views. They won't be the views of my government, right? But understand this. I'm this. This is me. But he just waved it all away. Fundamental Christian things just wave away. And I'm thinking, actually, that's a man that has no principles. Instantly.
I agree with you. That's my view of him too. I don't even think he's a person. He's an imaginary.
Well, it's a funny thing about the modern world, isn't it? Because you see these chief executives and senior management people, and they speak incomprehensibly. And they have zero leadership ability other than a gaining of consensus and sticking in the middle and not rocking the boat. Oh, I honestly,
that's my view of the present government. It's everywhere. That's what I see. Yeah. Basically, I see a nothing event.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm 100% with you. I go on Bob McCroskey's show. It's on tonight, actually. It's not. I got the days mixed up. But I go on his show, and they're all conservatives. And they got to give – he asked beginning of this year what we rated the government at. And everyone's saying, oh, 5 or 6, you know. And what do you think, Rodney? I said 0. 0 out of 10. They all – I said, well, I'm a on or off guy, right? Either like it or I don't. But for all the reasons we just announced, just muddling along, fiddling away. They're literally playing a little Wellington game, keep the media on board, do a little bit of a tax cut, or we'll reduce school lunches a little bit, or we'll sack a few bureaucrats. And you say, where do you see New Zealand in 5 years' time, 10 years' time? Not a clue. And I think they're burnishing their CVs or enjoying just being there. They're not there for a purpose.
It's not my territory, Rodney, but I see the government as an absence in every possible way. I don't think there's anything happening there that's got any style or purpose or function at all. They just make the rules now. And I find it's very disappointing. And I have for some time.
I found when I was a minister that I was shocked on the one hand how much power I had and shocked at the same time at how little I had, right? So you can literally walk into a meeting and they're saying, we need you to decide A or B, Minister. And these are things that they don't have an answer to. And you say, A, done. And the whole ship would head off an A and you'd feel very proud of yourself, right? But these were the questions that didn't have a answer, that they needed to kick it upstairs and just have someone say, oh, yeah, boy, flip a coin, whatever. And they liked me because I'd always give an answer and we'd carry on. But I realised that I was utterly dependent on the ministry. Utterly dependent on them. They would warn me of the dangers. They would provide me with the information to counter opposition attack. They would make me look competent. They would get good information for my speeches that was true and accurate. And they had my back, literally. I knew that if I upset them, they could have me dead in a week, because they'd make me look incompetent.
Would they? Do they do that?
Oh, of course. They have to like you to some extent to make sure, oh, Minister, here, quick, you need this. Oh, bugger him. And you walk into Parliament with the wrong information, just because they, quote, didn't get it to you in time. It's that subtle. And you realise it. And they're literally, they're very competent people falling over backwards to make you look good. But you know, you have, it's a mutual interest. If you follow me, they'll look after you if you look after them. And so the system, the entire system is looking after itself. And so you would literally be Andrew Little, and you'd say to your justice officials, oh, look, I read Trial by Trickery. I knew, by the way, when we saw him, it was never going to happen. I did it out of loyalty to you and deference to you. I knew that that was a complete waste of time. So what would happen with Andrew Little is he'd be sitting there and saying, oh, by the way, officials, I've read Trial by Trickery and met with Keith Hunter, and he's not mad, you know. He's very sensible guy. And he's got some very sensible points. And they'd say, oh, Minister, you don't want to go there. There are things about this case that you don't want to know. Oh, okay. Cheerio.
Did that actually happen?
No.
Oh.
But I guarantee if he raised it, it would. I've seen that time and time again when I've taken things to ministers, and I've had it done to me as an MP, where I've raised an issue about a constituent and they've said to me, there's more about this than you want to know, Mr. Hyde. Oh, I've said, could you tell me? Unfortunately, we can't. Oh, why can't you? Oh, because of the Privacy Act. You know what I've done every time? I learned to do this. I'd go back to the constituent. In fact, I learned to do this when the constituent walked into my office. I said, if you're serious about this case, I'll take it for you, but you need to give me a privacy waiver. What's that? I need you write to me, to whom I can tell, I can't remember how I'd word it. I got a lawyer to do it for me. And I'd go to the department, not a problem, here's a waiver. I used to get constituents to appoint me as their tax agents. So I'd say to the idea, it's not a problem. I'm an appointed tax agent for this constituent. You can share every bit of the file with me. Invariably, they'd have nothing.
Oh.
And of course, I had a couple of constituents come to see me who wouldn't give me a privacy waiver because they knew that there was a bit more to the case than they were telling me, right? But someone who's innocent of what they're being fitted up for, the tax bill, they'd instantly give you a waiver. So you go to the officials. Oh, no, it's a fantastic thing. I had another one. And then we're talking about Scott Watson, but it's germane to it. I've discussed this on Reality Check Radio one other time, but it bears repeating. I had a friend before I went into politics, an acquaintance, and he's very senior in government, and we knew each other. And I was an academic, and he admired what I was doing, and I admired him for his achievement and his intelligence. And I discovered that the Inland Revenue Department were acting way out of any civilized behavior. They were rogue operatives. And there were suicides of people who were being hounded unjustly. And I started raising this in Parliament and kicking up Bobsy Dye. And Paul Holmes picked up on it. And it became a big thing. Ended up having an inquiry. The IRD commissioner had to leave. The deputy commissioner left. It was all replaced. The law was changed. And it was sort of tidied up. But, of course, it's reverted back to form now. But I was doing this. And my friend acquaintance came up to me at a function. He said, oh, how are you going? Oh, great. I was a brand fresh MP, innocent. He said, oh, Rodney, you know, about this IRD stuff, you know, just, you shouldn't really be doing it the way you're doing it, which was to expose it, which I thought was my job. Oh, I said, you know, politely, why not? Well, you know, it's just not a good look for the government. When he meant government, he didn't mean the party in power. He meant the government as a whole. And I said, yeah, but all this bad stuff is going on. And whatever I'd recently exposed, I detailed for him, including a man's death in a heinous way. And he said, yes. All of that's true. But what happens if people lose faith in the government?
I think there's a lot of lack of faith in the government in New Zealand right now. I think that's where we are.
But you see, that will be the thinking that you'll get taught in the Justice Department, right? In the police. And that's how cover-ups are justified. Because, Keith, you're new to the police. It's very, very important that people have confidence in the police. And yes, we don't always get it right. And there might be an innocent man in jail, but it's more important that people have faith in the police. Otherwise, we have anarchy. And I think, well, that's been my experience. Because, and you and I both know, that what gives you confidence in the system is exposure, transparency, and proper accountability, right? We're considered the least corrupt country in the world, and I used to believe that. And when I became an MP, I realized we were the least corrupt because no one would look. No one would look.
Well, that seems to apply to the Watson case. Pretty well, it seems to me. I mean, this man is patently innocent. There is not a jot of evidence against him, and heaps of evidence in his favour. Heaps and heaps. And here he is. He's been in jail for 26 years. How can that happen? I don't understand how that can possibly happen. I don't get it. No one in there with the power gives a damn. I mean, maybe this new Court of Appeal thing will work, but I don't know. If they're only looking at what I understand them to be looking at, then why? They need to look at the whole thing.
How does someone listening get a hold of your book? Is it in the library? Can they buy it?
It's in the library. It should be able to buy it off my website too. Yes, it's in the library. The copy's in the libraries. But it should be available off my website. But I discovered yesterday that there's something wrong with the site and I'm trying to get it fixed up.
Okay. Well, look in the library. The book is Trial by Trickery by Keith Hunter.
Right.
It's a wonderful book. I use the word wonderful, but with caution. My dad read it. And actually, I tell a lie. He watched your documentary. And then he read your book, I think. I think I've got that right. And he was very elderly. He was enraged beyond belief.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
And so it's a wonderful book, but it does make you angry. And I read your book, my goodness, how long ago? 20 years.
Yeah.
And I can recall the book, and it makes me angry. And it, like I said, I think about Scott Watson constantly. Yeah. And it's very hard to live with as a Kiwi that an innocent man is condemned to jail.
Yep. And he's been there for 26 years. He started at 26. He's now 52 or thereabouts. He's lost his 30s and 40s, all that precious time of life, gone.
And I think, am I correct in saying if he had said, yes, I did it, he'd be out by now?
He would, that's right. He'd be out on parole, yep.
But he refuses to say he did it because he didn't do it.
Yep.
That correct. Alone tells you something. Like,
he would have been out 6 or 8 years ago if he'd said, yes, I did it, and give me parole.
At least. Damn, that's a tough guy.
Hmm.
Just the system's got to look at that. The whole system is saying to him, Scott, all this will go away if you just say you did it and you'll be out. And they would be off the hook. And he won't.
It's so apparent that he's innocent. It's so obvious. I don't know how anybody can look at the material, not just what I've written, but what others have written. There's 5 or 6 books on it.
Yes.
It's caused 5 or 6 people who've thought about it to write books, to research and write books about it. And nothing makes a difference. I mean, everyone I've spoken to about this present Court of Appeal hearing are of the view that it's not going to make any difference.
Keith, it's wonderful to talk to you. This is Keith Hunter on Reality Check Radio. He's a wonderful human being, as you heard. He's done an amazing job. He's had an amazing career, and he sort of literally puts it on hold because he gets seized by justice. And he's been tireless. But as he says, he's pulled back from the Scott Watson case because you can imagine it. Having a truth seeker who wants accountability makes it harder for the authorities to admit they're wrong.
That's unfortunately true.
But they double down. Keith, I'd love you to come back.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
You're so wonderful, and I got carried away talking, but
yeah.
I'd love to cover off with you the missing bloodstain.
I don't mind doing that at all.
There you go. That's the crew murders in the book.
Yep.
The book, The Missing Bloodstain by Keith Hunter, extraordinarily is better than Trial by Trickery in a sense of the investigation and what is uncovered. It's I would say one of the top two books I've read, non-fiction New Zealand books. The second one is Mark of a Lion about Charles Upham, which is an extraordinary book. But this book, The Missing Bloodstain, oh my goodness, it's so... The Case of the Missing Bloodstain, oh my goodness, it is such a wonderful insight into how things can happen, but it's so wonderfully put together and written. Keith Hunter, I thank you for coming on our show. Now, there'll be lots of feedback, lots of people probably saying, oh no, Scott Watson did it, or I saw this. Please, you know me, and I'd love anyone to come on the show who thinks that Scott did it and explain why. That would be great. We welcome that. You won't get a hostile interview from me. We'll just try to get to the truth because our courts clearly didn't. Send me a text at 2057, please, and email me inbox@realitycheck.radio. And aren't we blessed amongst us to have Keith Hunter as a great guest to come on the show, and it says something that he's not weekly on TV.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.